Okay, good evening, everybody. Thanks for joining. Let's all have a stand up. Yeah, let's all have a stand up. And let's all turn around and face away from me. Good, and now turn face me, and I'll sit down. I don't know why, I just wanted to do that. That was for no reason at all. Yeah. It's a good stretch break before we start. Yeah. Okay, so today's topic is marriage is dead. Okay, so we're going to start off by, I'll start off by asking you guys. Yes, Mima? That's okay. That's another topic for another day. We'll talk after. Yeah. You should see the other guy. Yeah, that's why I'm giving this topic, exactly. My marriage is dead. That's the topic. No. Okay, so first question is, it's kind of phrased in two different ways, depending on what stage you are in life. Since you're single, what are your expectations of marriage? Or when you were single, for those of us who are in relationships or married, what were your expectations of marriage? So I think everybody can answer this question. You can take a second to think about it, but what were your expectations, or what are your expectations about marriage? Sacrament, not agreement, good, yeah. What else? Anybody else have thoughts? How about the married people? What were your expectations of marriage before you were married? Exactly where you're living right now? So, you must have had pretty bad expectations. kidding. I'm gonna throw some really negative statistics at you guys, okay? Over the last 40 years, the leading marriage indicators, so empirical definitions of marriage and health satisfaction in the United States, have been in steady decline. The divorce rate is nearly twice the rate it was in 1960, in the United States. In 1970, 89% of all births were to married parents, but today only 60% are. Over 72% of American adults were married in 1960, but only 50% were in 2008. Okay? All of this shows an increasing suspicion and pessimism about marriage in our culture. And this is especially true with younger adults. Okay? They believe their chances of having a good marriage are not great, and even if a marriage is stable, there is, in their view, the horrifying prospect that it will become sexually boring. As comedian Chris Rock points, do you want to be single and lonely, or married and bored? Many young adults believe that there are indeed two main options. That is why many aim for something kind of in the middle, between marriage and just sexual encounters, cohabitation with your partner, okay? And this practice has grown exponentially in the last three decades, okay? Today, more than half of all people live together before getting married. In 1960, virtually no one did. One quarter of all unmarried women between the ages of 25 and 39 are currently living with a partner. And by their late 30s, over 60% will have done so. Driving this practice are several widespread beliefs. One is the assumption that most marriages are unhappy. After all, the reasoning goes, 50% of all marriages end in divorce, and surely many of the other 50% must be miserable. Living together before marriage, most people argue, improves your chances of making a good marriage choice. It helps you discover whether you are compatible before you take the plunge. It's a way to discover if the other person can really keep your interest or if the chemistry is strong enough. Okay. Does this concur at all with kind of what you see in the world or what your thoughts are or how you see the world today? Yeah, a little bit, right? Yeah. Marriage is not like kind of in its best form or its best state right now, right? A lot of the talk about marriage is negative, right? And I have several friends of mine and colleagues of mine who say they never want to get married, right? And marriage is useless or pointless usually ends in devastation. And they have statistics to back it up. Well, I'm going to give you some statistics. A substantial body of evidence indicates that those who live together before marriage are more likely to break up after marriage. Cohabitation is an understandable response from those who experience their own parents' painful divorces. But the facts indicate that the cure may be worse than the disease. Other common assumptions are wrong as well. While it is true that some 45% of marriages end in divorce, by far the greatest percentage of divorces happen to those who marry before the age of 18, who have dropped out of high school, and who have had a baby together before marrying. So if you're a reasonably well-educated person with a decent income, come from an intact family, and are religious, and marry after 25 without having a baby first, your chances of having a divorce are very low indeed. Many young adults argue for cohabitation because they feel they should own a home and be financially secure before they marry. The assumption is that marriage is a financial drain. But studies point to what have been called the surprising economic benefits of marriage. A 1992 study of retirement data shows that individuals who were continuously married had 75% more wealth at retirement than those who had never married or who divorced and did not remarry. Even more remarkably, married men have been shown to earn 10 to 40% more than do single men with similar education and job histories. All surveys tell us that the number of married people who say they are very happy in marriage is high, about 61 to 62%. And there's been little decrease in this figure during the last few decades. Most striking of all, longitudinal studies demonstrate that 2/3 of those unhappy marriages out there will become happy within 5 years if people stay married and do not get divorced. So if you're unhappy now, 2/3 of unhappy couples and marriages right now, if you ask them in 5 years, they'll say we're happy. This led University of Chicago's sociologist Linda J. White to say the benefits of divorce have been oversold. During the last 2 decades, the majority of research evidence shows that people who are married consistently show much higher degrees of satisfaction with their lives than those who are single, divorced, or living with a partner. It also reveals that most people are happy in their marriages, and most of those who are not and who don't get divorced eventually become happy. Also, children who grow up in married, two-parent families have 2 to 3 times more positive life outcomes than those who do not. The overwhelming verdict is that being married and growing up with parents who are married is an enormous boost to our well-being. Basically, if we can get married, it's the best thing for us. Belief in the desirability and goodness of marriage was once universal, but that's no longer true. A recent report by the University of Virginia's National Marriage Project concluded the following. Less than 1/3 of high school senior girls and only slightly more than 1/3 of boys seem to believe that marriage is more beneficial to individuals than the alternatives. So less than 1/3. Yet this negative attitude is contrary to the available evidence, which consistently indicates the substantial personal as well as social benefits of being married compared to staying single or just living with someone. The report argues that the views of most young adults are not only unsupported by consensus and against the teaching of all major religions in the world, but also unsupported by the evidence of most recent social science. So where did this pessimism come from, and why is it so out of touch with reality? It may be the pessimism might come from a new kind of unrealistic idealism about marriage, born of a significant shift in our culture's understanding of the purpose of marriage. Legal scholar John White Jr. said that the earlier ideal of marriage as a permanent contractual union designed for the sake of mutual love, procreation, and protection is slowly giving way to a new reality of marriage as a terminal sexual contract designed for the gratification of the individual parties. So recently, New York Times columnist Tara Parker Pope wrote an article entitled "The Happy Marriage is the Me Marriage" in the New York Times. And this is what she says, we'll read it. "The notion that the best marriages are those that bring satisfaction to the individual may seem counterintuitive. After all, isn't marriage supposed to be about putting the relationship first? Not anymore. For centuries, marriage was viewed as an economic and social institution, and the emotional and intellectual needs of the spouses were secondary to the survival of the marriage itself. But in modern relationships, people are looking for a partnership, and they want partners who make their lives more interesting, who help each of them attain valued goals. Marriage used to be a public institution for the common good, and now it is a private arrangement for the satisfaction of the individuals. Basically, marriage used to be about us, but now it is about me." Okay? So that's written in the New York Times by a journalist, okay? And I think we can all relate to kind of how that relationship of marriage is today, right? Instead of finding meaning through self-denial, through giving up one's freedoms, and binding oneself to the duties of marriage and family, marriage has been redefined as finding emotional and sexual fulfillment and self-identity understanding. How would you guys describe this shift in your own words? Yeah, we can pass the mic, or we can get a wireless. Or just yell. So Sammy said he's noticing less couples kind of sacrificing for the relationship. And Miriam?
It's supposed to be sacrificial love, but now it's selfish love, and there's no Christ in there, so there's no Christ.
Good.
Let me just find the sentence. It basically talks about how now it's partners help each other attain their goals.
Like a business deal.
Sorry?
Like a business deal.
Sure.
Like, you give me this, I'll give you this, and as long as there's that kind of contract, then the marriage continues, right? But what happens when someone isn't able to fill their end of the bargain, right?
Yeah. So I didn't really think about it as a business deal. I mean,
yeah.
I guess from a different perspective, you would see it as a business deal. But I thought that in marriage, we are expected to help our partners reach and attain their goals.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really understand why this would.
I think that's fine, and I think gratifying your partner and, you know, fulfilling them and all those things are good things. Those aren't negative things. What has happened though is that people go into marriage with that as their primary, you know, driver, and it's just you're setting yourself up for failure, and you're setting your expectations up for very unrealistic expectations, right? You know, like let's say I want to get married and I want to find someone with X, Y, and Z, right? I want someone A who I see nothing wrong with, right? I don't want to change the person, okay? So I have to find someone who I don't see anything wrong with, and I need to find someone who doesn't see anything wrong with me either, right? Because I don't want anyone to change me. I want them to accept me for who I am. So I don't want it. I want someone who's kind of perfect, and who sees me as perfect, and there needs to be this constant sexual attraction. We always want to have to get in. We always want to get into bed with each other, okay? And she has to be a great Christian, right? Those expectations are setting us up for failure, right? There's no way we can find someone, because first of all, no one's perfect. I'm not perfect, and no, there isn't this unrelenting, you know, urges all the time, right? So if we go into kind of wanting to find someone with those characteristics, we're going to set ourselves up for failure. And in marriage, we'll set ourselves up, like in our marriage, we'll set ourselves up. Because if we're only in it for our self-gratification, what happens when the other person doesn't satisfy us or doesn't fulfill us? Then the easiest thing to do is cut and look for someone else, right? And then that doesn't work out either, right? So it's kind of ironic in that, you know, this post-enlightenment marked by gratification, satisfaction, and fulfillment of our desires, view of marriage, actually puts a huge amount of expectation on the spouses in a way that the church never intended, you know? The church never intended for us to have that huge burden, a huge expectation of marriage, you know? And most other religions and traditional beliefs don't either, right? It leaves us desperately trapped between both unrealistic longings and terrible fears about marriage. Anybody have anything to add before we move on? Yeah, so it just sets up unrealistic expectations if we go in with kind of this me marriage approach that was never intended, right? And this is something that's kind of new. Yeah.
Like from a non-religious perspective, like what is the point of marriage?
Good question. I don't think there's a non-religious point of marriage. I think marriage is an institution created by God for procreation, one, for the proper rearing of children in a safe and good nurturing environment, partnership, you know. And there's a couple of points later on with what I think is the purpose of marriage and what God's purpose of marriage is for us. But in terms of a non-religious perspective, I mean, if you're going into a non-religious perspective and you don't think, and you think that this person that you're marrying is going to be perfect, and it's not true. And I'll talk a little bit about it later, but, you know, when you get married to someone, you're really marrying a stranger. And the truth of it is, like, it takes years to know someone, you know? And even if you know someone before marriage is so large. It's such a large institution in of itself, in that there is kind of, that barrier is kind of lifted, right? That it changes people. Like, the marriage itself will change people, right? So, saying that you know someone going into marriage is bollocks. Ready?
It's a non-religious background. I think it goes back to the business deal, and some people go in it purely for financial reasons. Mm-hmm. Like, you get cheaper insurance rates if you're married.
It's like the Donald Trump, Melania Trump, you know, exchange. Like, a rich billionaire, I'm pretty good looking. Anyways. Yeah. Which one's the good looking one?
I think business deal. I think, though, like, from a non-religious perspective, you can say, like, it's established to, like, so you have someone to support you and you support mm-hmm. them. Like, I think that's something valid to say.
Yeah. And that's why a lot of marriages fail if something goes wrong, right? If the husband gets a spinal cord injury and is unable to provide for his family, you know, then the wife moves on, right? Or something else, right?
I think another thing too is, like, what I find, especially if it's very rampant, this idea is rampant in the pop culture and stuff, is that when you marry, is that you go into marriages because of love and this, like, kind of, yeah. like, wishy-washy version of love where it's not about sacrifice, it's just about feelings and the way you see it in the movies and, like, if this person, like, it doesn't matter if there's X, Y, Z wrong with this person, if I love them, then they're perfect and all this stuff where it's very unrealistic and when as soon as you run into a problem, you don't know what to do and you say, oh, like, how did this happen? This was supposed to be perfect and my fairy tale come true.
Fairy tale come true. But marriage is not a fairy tale. It's hard, right? From people I've talked to about it. But it's kind of like a relationship with God, right? It's not easy, you know. It's not easy to wake up in the morning and pray, and it's not easy to come to church every Sunday and to serve. That's not easy, but it's rewarding and it's glorious, right? So, in a similar way in marriage with our relationship with our spouses, it's not easy to sacrifice and to wake up early and do something for them and whatever, right? It's not easy, but it's glorious and wondrous. Okay. That comes to our next point. Knowing our spouse is difficult and painful, but rewarding and wondrous. And in marriage, we're forced to change our natural instincts, rein in our passions, learn denial of our own desires, and to serve others. What makes this hard is that we have two flawed people, two sinners, coming together to create a space of stability, love, and consolation, or a haven in a heartless world. The Christian view of marriage does not offer a choice between fulfillment and sacrifice, but rather mutual fulfillment through mutual sacrifice. Author Keller writes that, that's bringing us to our next point, but you can't separate fulfillment and sacrifice. They go hand in hand in marriage. And that's challenging because we have two selfish, right? We're all selfish. Two selfish people coming together, right? And trying to sacrifice for each other. And it's not always going to be good, right? Marriage unites strangers. That's my next point. Author Keller, Tim Keller, writes that when you first fall in love, you think you love the person, but you don't really. You can't know that person right away. That takes years. You actually love the idea of the person, and that is always, at first, one-dimensional and somewhat mistaken. But one quickly learns that marriage brings you into a more intense proximity to another human being than any other relationship can. Beyond that, over the years, you will go through seasons in which you have to learn to love a person you didn't marry, who is something of a stranger. You will have to make changes that you don't want to make, and so will your spouse. Stanley Hauerwas argues that the primary problem in many marriages is learning how to love and care for the stranger to whom you find yourself married. Marriage brings out and reveals traits in you that were there all along, but were hidden from everyone, including yourself. But now they are all seen by your spouse. In marriage, you're exposed. It's like taking off your mask and having your face stripped away. Marriage does not so much bring you into confrontation with your spouse as confront you with yourself. That's the kind of point I brought on earlier about marriage uniting strangers, and the person that you marry is really a stranger to you, and it will reappear as a stranger to you throughout the marriage. Sammy?
Said the second line where it says you actually love the idea of the person. Mm-hmm. One of the monks in Texas was talking about marriage, and I was very surprised. Actually, he's one of the more like American monks. He's raised in America and everything. So I was surprised when he was talking about how a friend of his, he recommended like the way you should go about courtship is that it should be very distant,
And it shouldn't be like calling all the time and texting all the time and all this stuff that you should be, like he was talking about this one guy that had his eye on this girl at church, so his father of confession just told him to just observe just for a year and not actually interact with her, mm-hmm. because then he got to, but like not in a stalkerish way, like just like at church or service or things like that, but in a way that the girl didn't know, because that way he actually saw, like he learned about her with her without her knowing, because had she had known, she might have acted differently. Like the way, like sometimes when we think someone likes us or whatnot, then we act a certain way for them maybe to like us more, or maybe in some cases like us less, I don't know, but like that's what it reminded me of, that we fall in love with the idea of a person mm-hmm. rather than the actual person themselves.
Yeah, oftentimes we have to kind of dissociate love and like good love and kind of our ego or our lust or our emotions coming in, you know. I'll give you an example, like holding on to like your girlfriend's or your whoever's hand for that first time, you know, you'll get this rush of emotion and this butterfly feeling in your tummy. And really that's not love. That's someone who I care about cares about me as well. That's my ego, right? That's someone who I think is attractive finds me attractive. So that's not love. That's ego. That's my own ego coming in and that's stroking my own ego. So you kind of have to dissociate and differentiate between, you know, is this love or is this kind of my own ego coming in? In terms of like falling in love with the idea of someone and how do I know, like that's like maybe a different kind of angle, but like how do I know this is the right person to marry? You know, I think core values, like sharing core values and core beliefs, even though there might be differences in your either personality or kind of small little differences, as long as you share core values together and you're compatible, right? Some form of compatibility. Men and women will never be compatible fully because we're different genders, right? And I think that's kind of God's plan a little bit, is to unite people who are different through marriage, right? To unite two people who are different people, who are different gender, who have different beliefs and different ways of interacting with the world. And no matter how compatible they can be, they're still going to be a little bit different. And that's kind of God's way of unifying us as it's kind of like symbolic of him unifying us as a people, right? Through marriage, if that makes sense. It's a little abstract, but.
When you say that marriage, the love of marriage is solely based on exactly love, you say love of emotions?
No, I think a healthy dose of emotions and sexual attraction is important. And it's not like substitute one for the other. The problem is that we focus way too much in our culture or in our society about one and not the other types of love, the sacrifice love, the love that God showed for us, right, on the cross. That's love that doesn't exist anymore in our modern marriages, right? And as soon as something becomes challenging or hard, it's, hey, let's end this, right? Let's really end this relationship. It's not you, it's me, you know? So you can't substitute, you know, there needs to be sexual attraction, and that wasn't God's intent for us to marry people we're not attracted to or compatible with. That's not his intent at all. But you, typically for guys, you know, she has to be drop dead gorgeous, you know? And for girls, it's he has to be a real provider. You know, he's got to have a great job and he's got to have a nice car and whatever, right? I have neither of those. Yeah, it's stereotypical, but it's it's how our culture kind of design or molds us, so to say. So yeah, marriage unites strangers. Marriage unites people who are kind of unknown to each other. So, last point, and then we can open it up for discussion, I guess. So marriage is not the be-all, end-all, okay? We should neither be overly excited by marriage or disappointed about it. Because Christ is the only spouse that can truly fulfill us, and God's family is the only family that will truly embrace and satisfy us. The Christian hope makes it possible for singles to live fulfilled lives without a spouse or children, but it was also an incentive for people to marry and have children and not be afraid to bring them up into this dark world. See, without a deeply fulfilling love relationship with Christ now and hope in a perfect love relationship with him in the future, people will put too much pressure on marriage to fulfill them. So we need to guard from idolizing marriage, but also idolizing the independence or personal freedom that keeps us from getting married. So if we put too much pressure on our marriage to satisfy us and fulfill us in our lives, again, we're putting too much expectation on marriage, and it's going to be doomed to fail. Okay? Only Christ can satisfy us completely. That's it, guys. That's all I have.
As long as you're living with Christ, that you should be open to the possibility that you may or may not get married.
Yep.
As opposed to setting up like, yep, I want to get married or I want to stay single kind of thing.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, the existence of Christ, you know, like we can live fulfilled lives single. We can live fulfilled lives. And it's written, it's biblical too. I'm not just pulling this, you know. St. Paul says, actually, you know, I'm paraphrasing for sure. I don't know the verse by heart, but he says something along the lines of like, if you can get away not getting married, don't get married. Pretty much. But sometimes we idolize the personal freedoms and the liberty and the the independence, and that kind of pushes us away from marriage in our culture. I want to be by myself. I don't want someone to wake up next to me and tell me what to do and stuff like that. But, yeah, which is not right either.
I actually read this really cool article about this, and the word submit, the way that we use it today is very different from the ancient translation. So when it talks about submit in the ancient translation, it's more of a reverence and a respect from the husband or for the husband, but this is only in the context that the husband is behaving as Christ would. So naturally, when you think about it, obviously no one wants to, like, if you have a really bad husband and stuff, then like who is not Christ-like and godly, and he's saying scrub the floors and make me a sandwich and do whatever thing, like, you're, that's not what it means to submit to him and just to do whatever he wants. But if your husband is Christ-like, then naturally you will submit to him, and in the sense that naturally you will revere him and honor him as Christ would. And in the same sense, when it says wives or husbands, love your wives, and just the same way as Christ gave himself up for the church. So the husband has the job to sacrifice himself completely for the wife. So it's like two different forms of respect, but one isn't like less than the other or more honored than the other. So it explains that. 30.
Takes like Ephesians 5:22, and it's like there's no 21, and 21 is literally submitting to one another in the fear of God, and when Anthony gave a talk about this recently, he was talking in the fear of God, which is basically something God would ask for. So if a spouse is asking for something that isn't aligned with what God is asking for, then it doesn't meet the criteria. So it's kind of like the fine print at the bottom to get excluded, or like you get to exclude whatever is being asked.
Also, to that point, people skip 25, like the Samuel saying, like, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. Like, you're called to give your life for your wife. Like, not to submit, but to also be, like, it's not to say one's more than the other. But it's not just, like, it doesn't stop at wives submit to your husband. It doesn't stop there. So that you need to keep it in, like, in perspective that the husband's also called to make a very great sacrifice and to be very watchful and purposeful in his marriage.
Some good wedding advice I got, or marriage advice I got once, was each of you give 100% without expecting anything in return, and you'll have a happy marriage.
I think when people read it, they think it's like, it's the same as saying, like, the way employers submit to their, like, bosses, yeah. But it's not the same.
I don't think it's meant to be like cisseid at all. But. Mark?
Also, one thing to just add, something really great I heard from a priest. He was saying there's kind of like three things you want to look for in somebody who you think is the one. So he's saying, one, like, you need to know that God has kept this person for you, and, sorry, neither distance nor time will separate you from that person. And this priest was speaking from a place where he was in Vancouver for a while, his wife was like in Africa, like it was just completely different time zones, and it was difficult for sure. And so you have to bear that in mind, and then also that you know, this the person you're looking at has to have an intimate relationship with God, to talk to him, to really know him, to really want to be close to him. And then he was saying number three is not only to know God and say, you know, I fear God, but really to obey his word. Because it's easy to say, you know, I'm a Christian and I do this and I do that, but to really follow. And then generally after that, you know, everybody kind of has their own preferences on whatever it may be. Maybe Andrew likes someone with blue eyes. You know, maybe I like somebody who has a sense of humor. Like, everybody has kind of their things after that matter. But I think if you kind of hit those three criteria after that, it's pretty much up to you.
I'm sorry. I know I'm talking a lot, but I remember something Mark Dawood said when he gave us a similar topic a while ago. He was saying, he said this quote, it said, run towards God, and if someone keeps up, introduce yourself. So it's like you have God as your goal, and if you see that in someone else, then you know that should be your primary focus, is both having God both in your life, because he's what's going to keep the marriage together. It's not going to be your own strength or like your own will that's going to keep a marriage together. It's going to be God. And the fact that, like, a marriage is part of the purpose of marriage is building a church, mm-hmm. in your own house.
No, I don't think so. No. If someone's not close to God, should they not get married? I think knowing God or having a relationship with God might make your marriage a little bit easier. I think you can get to know God through marriage. It's not a great way to try, but it's, you can get to know God through marriage, I think, based on some of the reading I've done. But no, I don't think if you're not godly or if you're not close to God, it's a reason not to get married.
Almost giving yourself an excuse to not get close to God.
Yeah, I think marriage can kind of pull the best in us if we let it. Becoming kind of the best forms of ourselves, becoming selfless, becoming responsible, becoming, if we kind of step up to the plate, right? If you guys want to do more reading, I didn't do any of this lesson. Like, I just read a lot, and I put things together. But three books I can recommend. One is called Sacred Marriage. I can't remember the author of that book. Second book, The Meaning of Marriage by Tim Keller. I quoted him a lot in this lesson. And the third one is Marriage and Gospel Focus. So if you guys are interested in doing more reading, or I recommend that for people who are married, who are thinking about marriage, or who are on the fence, or engaged, or whatever. It's a great books, for sure. All right, let's stand up for prayer. How about the hand? O Lord, make us worthy to pray thankfully. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil one. Christ Jesus, our Lord, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen.